Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast zooming in on the world's political, security and social shifts through the lens of its media.
A complete lack of control of the state and the government.
Conflicting narratives.
They're feeling the impact of this war.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service.
From the BBC World Service, this edition of the documentary podcast is the first of four programmes, Forward Thinking, a new series where we explore ideas that could transform our world. We're here with a live audience at the Oxford Literary Festival with The Telegraph. I'm Nuala McGovern. For centuries, scholars, artists, writers, scientists, filmmakers have found inspiration where we are. In Oxford's spectacular architecture, the city's famous Dreaming Spires, and it is quite the place to have conversations about big ideas. Some of the scholars that Oxford has educated include the poet W.H. Auden, President Bill Clinton, chef Nigella Lawson, and the scientist Stephen Hawking. And Oxford has also educated 28 Nobel Prize winners. Well, we have our Nobel Prize winner for chemistry with us today, Venki Ramakrishnan, author of Why We Die, The New Science of Aging and the Quest for Immortality. Welcome, Venki.
Thank you.
Now, we all have skin in the game of aging, some of it more wrinkled than others. Why have you decided to devote so much thought to the concept and the reality of aging?
Several reasons. One is that humans have wondered about our mortality ever since we were aware of it. We may be the only species that knows that we have an expiration date on our lives. Many other species are aware of death, but not necessarily about lifespan and mortality. For most of our existence, we couldn't do anything about it. But now, with strides in modern biology, we're beginning to understand the underlying basis for why we age and how that leads to death. And that's leading to questions about whether we can intervene in that process and slow it down or perhaps postpone it significantly. So that's one reason. The other reason is that there's an enormous amount of hype in the field. Some of it is because there's a huge amount of private capital that has gone into funding aging research. We have a number of billionaires who are reaching middle age and thinking this would be a good thing to invest in. And so that's distorted claims in the field. Now, my lab doesn't work on aging, but the things I study, namely how proteins are made in the cell, is actually central to aging. And so I watched with alarm the growing amount of hype in the field, and I thought it'd be a good thing to take a hard look at the field and see what the biology tells us and ask what the prospects are.
Probably no surprise to anyone that when we ask this question on the World Service Facebook page, everybody has an opinion on what should or should not happen. I want to play a listener, and this is from the DRC, from the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Hello, BBC. This is Mika Biabuze from DR Congo. My question is, what ethical consideration should guide the development and the implementation of anti-aging treatment to ensure that they promote not only extended lifespan, but also enhanced quality of life and well-being for individuals as they age?
So, what are the ethics of aging? What are the implications if we decide to prolong life?
The listener brings up two very interesting points. One is the quality of life, and then the other is the broader question of extension of life. Now, it is true that we've doubled lifespan over the last 150 years or so, but it turns out that in the advances over the last few decades, we've increased lifespan, but we have not increased health span. So we're spending about the same fraction of our lives in poor health, which is to say more years of our lives in poor health. So the question is, can we increase the fraction of our lives that we live healthily and independently and productively? That's what the aging community is aiming for.
When do we begin to age?
I don't think there's a fixed criterion, but if you look at certain biological markers, you age almost from the time you're born. So early on, you're both developing and aging.
Huh.
Then, you know, once you reach maturity, from then on, you continue to age. But of course, if you're asking when do we really noticeably start to decline, that's highly variable. And you can't define it chronologically. And that's why biologists are looking for alternative markers of aging, which better tell a person's biological age. Because we all know 70-year-olds who are very spry and can do all sorts of things, and others who are really, feeling their age.
But is aging a disease, or do you get disease from aging?
It is true that many of the disabilities we suffer as we age, for example, diabetes, heart disease, even cancer, dementia, all of these things increase in frequency with age. And so there is a school of thought that says that, well, actually, it's aging itself that's the disease, and it has multiple manifestations in these various diseases. I think that something that happens to everyone, and that's, as far as our natural biology goes, is inevitable. I don't see how you could classify it as a disease. But as I say, there's a difference of opinion.
You know, you mentioned cancer there. Dementia, the figures in your book were startling. More than 50 million people worldwide, 78 million expected by 2030, 139 million by 2050. And if these are figures that we wouldn't have seen before, because people wouldn't have lived as long.
Yes, that's right. So if you went back 150 years, very few people actually developed dementia because they simply didn't live that long. Now we're living longer because we've managed to tackle many of the problems of infectious disease, heart disease, diabetes, etc. And so we're living longer and facing that onset of dementia. And the problem is that brain diseases are particularly hard to cure, partly because neurons don't regenerate. It's hard to get drugs into the brain because of the blood-brain barrier. And even the problem of dementia itself, it's a complex disease that involves our very own proteins misfolding and misbehaving. It's a hard problem to tackle. So the number of people with dementia is going to grow until we can do something about it.
Humans are somewhat of an outlier, you mention in your book, when we talk about lifespan. Perhaps you could tell us more about a tortoise, for example, the giant tortoise, or whales. Why do they live so long? Give an idea of their lifespan.
Yeah.
What's the difference? Like, what have they got that we haven't got?
Well, it is a little strange that we're all made of the same biological material. We're all made of DNA, proteins, carbohydrates, lipids, etc. And yet, lifespan varies enormously. So the record holder at the short end is a mayfly, which only lives for a day. And then at the other end, you have giant tortoises, which live over 150 years, or a bowhead whale, which lives 200 or 300 years, a Greenland shark, which has lived over 400 years. So you have an enormous variation. And it leads people to think that death is somehow programmed, that there's some biological program operating in each species that allows it to live for a certain amount of time. That isn't actually what most biologists believe. Most biologists agree that what evolution selects for is fitness, which is the likelihood of being able to pass on your genes. So if you're a small animal like a mouse, there's no point in biology spending a lot of resources maintaining and repairing the individual if it's going to be eaten or starved to death long before the aging process kicks in. So there, it's more advantageous for biology to spend its resources on rapid growth and maturation and fecundity so that it produces a a lot of offspring. With larger animals, the equation changes. It then becomes more advantageous to live longer, so you can produce more offspring over a longer lifetime. So I think for each species, a balance has been arrived at by natural selection that determines lifespan. So death is not programmed. It's simply that evolution doesn't really care what happens after you've passed on your genes. So we're, in a way, our body really, you can think of as a vessel for our genes.
You are listening to Forward Thinking from the BBC World Service. We're at the Oxford Literary Festival at Worcester College. I'm Nuala McGovern. We are speaking about why we die and why we age. We have a live audience with us here asking some of the questions of my guest, Venki Ramakrishnan. You're making me think of menopause because a lot of women will go through it, let's say, early 50s, something like that. And once upon a time, yes, they would have died pretty soon after if they made it that far, but not now.
That's true. We're one of the few species where the females live long after menopause. Another species are orcas, killer whales. The reasons for menopause are debated. One idea is called the mother hypothesis, which is that you have to live long enough to make sure your children grow up to reproductive age. Mm. And since our species matures slowly, you have to live long enough after your last child to be able to take care of your children. Another is called the grandmother hypothesis, which is that you go through menopause, you don't have children, but then you help raise your grandchildren for the good of the species. A number of biologists don't like these theories, which are called adaptive theories, suggesting it has some benefit for the group as a whole. Many of them feel that actually our species lifespan has expanded over a relatively short period. And so the number of eggs that our species could produce over a lifetime evolved so that it would stop at about 45 or 50 or so. And now that we're living quite a long time past that, evolution simply hasn't had a chance to catch up with that.
So interesting. Any questions in the audience for Venki at the moment? Yes, this lady at the front, just give me one moment. We'll get a microphone right to you.
Hi, my name's Sarah. My question really goes to diversity and innovation, that if you just look at political leadership, thought leadership, we're not creating enough space for younger people because we dominate.
It's an aspect that you bring up called intergenerational fairness.
Yeah, I do bring up the idea of intergenerational fairness. I also think there's an asymmetry of power. As people get older, they're economically, on the whole, better off. So if you look at the oldest 20% of the population, they're much better off than young adults. They have more political power. They have more networks of influence. And I also think that many of the social changes, going all the way back to suffragettes and women's rights early on and civil rights, many of these things have been driven by younger people and new ideas, of course. And so I think we would be a poorer society if we didn't have that generational turnover. And I don't think it's simply a question of staying biologically healthy. I think a lot of creativity comes from the fact that when you're young, you're facing life for the first time. Everything's new. So you're looking at it with open-mindedness, with new eyes, and that may be part of that.
There's a couple of things that come to mind just as you're speaking. We have the US presidential election in November. We now know that the two candidates running, one is 81, the other is 78, as in Joe Biden and Donald Trump. But we also know that the people who go to vote in the biggest numbers are usually the older generation.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I would say, since you brought up that election, if you had two older people running for office, would you prefer someone who's very top-down and sort of dictates things from the top, or would you prefer someone who surrounds himself with a very active team of diverse ages? You know, I know which I would prefer.
Another gentleman in the audience. Hello, welcome. What's your name and where are you from?
My name is Jim Naismith from Oxford. My question is, where do you think the upper limits will be? So we sort of know evolution must reach a point, because to keep the current body alive, the repairs just outweigh any advantage? And do you think that we're, you know, that is going to be just a hard limit that we might all get up to, and then that's it, where we just have to stop?
The oldest person on record to have lived was a French woman, Jeanne Calment, who lived to be 122. She died in 1997, and no one since then has crossed 120. And Tom Perls, a physician scientist in Boston who studies centenarians, told me that although the number of centenarians is increasing, he doesn't see a proportional increase in the number of people over 110. So this suggests that beyond 110, we're rapidly reaching the limits of our natural biology, the way we have evolved. So I think it's very unlikely that we would live past 120, even if everything went well. But I think what a number of aging scientists, not all of them, but some of them, believe is that if you tackle the underlying causes of aging, then you might be able to extend it beyond 120. And some, of course, at the extreme end of the spectrum believe you can extend it much further than that. I should say there are no physical or chemical laws that would say you can't do it, because there are species that live for a few hundred years. But of course, there's no physical or chemical law that you can't colonize other galaxies or even Mars, but it'd be extremely difficult. So.
I'd be curious in the room, if you could live to be 120, who would like to? Hands up. About half. 100? I think that's kind of, yeah, the other half. So something, what is it about
well,
the number 100? Yeah, go on.
There's the old joke about who on earth would want to live to be 100? And the answer is someone who's 99.
My mother says that joke. She's 89, but she tells that joke. She's like, yeah, I used to think, who wants to live to be 90? Let me tell you, when you're 89, you really want to. But, you know, with the study of centenarians, and I found this really interesting in your book, there are what we call, or what you call, survivors, delayers, and escapers. So these are people who, in relation to the diseases that will take people, whether it's cancer or heart disease or really the top four, dementia probably as well would be up there. Survivors, 38% before the age of 80, right, that they got these diseases. Delayers, 43% after 80, they got these diseases. And then the escapers, 19%, they got none of those diseases. And you talked about those that have a rapid decline at the end. But this healthy lifestyle, you know, for 100 years, what are they doing that we should be doing?
Well, that's the big question. And that's what people who study centenarians are trying to find out. So they really try to find out everything about their lifestyle, their environment, but they're also sequencing their genomes, trying to understand their genetics. So far, there are some hints, but no really definitive answers.
We have more questions with our audience there. Hello, what's your name? Where are you from?
My name's Salma. I'm from Jordan. I just wanted to ask about this idea of longevity. And at least in my lifetime, I noticed in the last 10 years, there's been this sort of toxic obsession with living longer and sort of a healthier lifestyle. And I taught yoga for a number of years and used to see that particularly in the yoga industry, and always felt that it was just an underlying fear of death. And I was wondering if you could comment on that, because I think that it can be quite harmful in some ways.
I do agree that it is an obsession, but I don't think it's a newfound obsession. If you look at, you know, the pharaohs, or even really many religions are all about viewing death as not final, but a transition to something else. Humans simply have not liked the idea that one day they're simply going to not exist anymore. And it's driven human culture ever since we've been aware of our mortality. The first emperor of China went to great pains to try to avoid death. He tried to get all sorts of potions. He sent emissaries to various places to find the elixir of life. And then eventually, when he knew he was going to die, he had constructed an elaborate city in Xi'an with a mausoleum and all these terracotta soldiers on the off chance that he would bodily be resurrected someday. So I think this is a long-standing fear. And I think what has happened today is that there are ways for people to cater to this fear.
You are listening to Forward Thinking from the BBC World Service. We're broadcasting in front of a live audience at Oxford University, and we are taking questions from our audience and also bringing in some of the questions that you posted on the BBC World Service Facebook page. We're going to take another question, gentlemen here in the central.
Thank you. My name's John from Newcastle upon Tyne. You talked about the underlying causes of ageing. Do we know what proportion of those would be genetic and which proportion would be environmental? And of the environmental ones, which are we in control of? What can we do to alter the odds, if you like?
Yeah, so I think the exact proportion isn't known. There was a study of twins in Denmark, which only attributed heritability to about 15 or 20%. It wasn't enormous, which suggests that there are many other factors involved in aging. However, biologists have also found single gene mutations, which hold true in worms, flies, and many other species, which have doubled lifespan. But those mutations aren't without side effects. They prevent early development and they reduce fertility. So these worms are unable to compete in the wild with other worms. So it comes at a price, that longevity. But that suggests that there are genes that are involved in longevity. In terms of environment, what's interesting is that one person who studied DNA damage, which is one of the fundamental causes that drives many other problems with aging, found that DNA damage is affected by just normal aqueous environments. You don't need carcinogens necessarily for DNA damage. And that's why we have this elaborate DNA repair machinery. So I'm sure that modern environments with toxic pollutants, etc., has not made it better for us. But I'm not sure that even in an ideal environment, we would be able to prevent environmental damage.
One more question here before we go to our Midway Bulletin.
Hello, my name is Jendrek. I'm a student here at Oxford. It seems there is a limit in how much we can do by changing our lifestyles and by using different therapeutics. But then over the last couple of months, we witnessed kidney transplants from pigs mm-hmm. that were grown in pigs. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, this might be a more efficient way to prolong our lives by just getting brand new organs from, for example, animal donors. And what's your ethical take on that?
Thank you, Jendrik. And we have actually another of our programs on Forward Thinking about whether veganism can save the world. It'd be a good question for that too. But what about on this discussion about why we die?
This is the idea of a body as a car, and you simply replace parts as you go and keep it going. I think there's a limit to it because these parts all have to work together. There are organs that are not so easily replaceable. For example, our bone marrow and our blood system. Not everything about us is neatly separable like a kidney. And also the brain is going to be very, very hard to replace, if at all. So I think this is not a viable option for living indefinitely.
Forever. Living forever or living for much longer, which is a conversation we are going to continue. From the BBC World Service, we're at the Oxford Literary Festival at Worcester College with a live audience. This is the documentary podcast. I'm Nuala McGovern. My guest is the Nobel Prize winner for chemistry, Venki Ramakrishnan, and author of Why We Die.
The information spaces we inhabit can resemble a hall of mirrors.
It's called guided democracy or managed democracy. There are different parties, different candidates, but everyone knows who is going to win.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast helping you make sense of them.
We've seen a crackdown on the opposition. We've seen an increase in censorship.
That's The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to Forward Thinking at the Oxford Literary Festival from the BBC World Service. This is the documentary podcast. I'm Nuala McGovern. And with me, my guest is Venki Ramakrishnan, author of Why We Die, The New Science of Aging and the Quest for Immortality. And this is something, Venki, that we begin to see more and more, I think, in news headlines, this quest for immortality, particularly some of it perhaps coming out of Silicon Valley. We have a live audience here in the room that are asking questions. We're going to be hearing from them in just a moment, but we also have a BBC listener who got in touch with us on the BBC World Service Facebook page. His name is Mario. He's in Thailand.
What if the Fountain of Life will be accessible only to the millionaires? What will be the impact on society? If people with a lot of power and money, and maybe with not the best characters and intentions, would have opportunity to live as long as vampires?
What about that? So people, and we know, right, are spending millions and billions on research to be perhaps wannabe vampires, many based in California, trying to see can they live forever or massively expand their lifespan. What do you make of it all?
The situation is already pretty bad. For example, even in wealthy countries like the US or the UK, the top 10% of the people live almost a decade longer than the bottom 10%. And it's even worse if you look at the fraction of their lives they live healthily.
Mm-hmm.
So the poor not only live shorter lives, but they live less healthy lives on the whole. So that's the situation now. Now, if in addition you now have really expensive treatments that allow the rich to live even longer, then you're going to create an even greater disparity. And the disparity could persist over generations, because the longer you live and the more healthily you live, you can produce more offspring and then they'll live longer. And you might get a sort of two-tiered society gradually over time. This raises another ethical question, that of wealth disparity or economic disparity in longevity. And this is something that societies and governments need to be aware of and do something about to make sure that advances in health are equitably distributed.
But reading your book, celebrity tech billionaires Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, Larry Page, Jeff Bezos, you'll know those names as Silicon Valley celebrities really that have worldwide fame, maybe thinking about space, and longevity seems to be the two buzzwords at the moment.
They're related, because in order to go really to outer space, you also need to be able to survive the voyage. And so you need to live for a very long time.
You need to have this super healthy body that can take it. 300,000 scientific articles on aging, 700 startup companies with billions of dollars invested. There was one gentleman that you talk about in your book that some of our listeners may have come across. His name is Brian Johnson. He spends $2 million a year on his anti-aging regime. Can you tell us a little bit about him and people like him, even if we're talking about cryogenics?
I think, you know, people can look him up. I want to address a more general question about the amount of money in aging. It's not just driven by these people, although that distorts the process somewhat. But it's because societies are facing an aging population. So if you look at Britain around 1920 or 1900, a much greater fraction was young. And all developed societies are facing an increasingly aging population. And so governments all over have made this a priority, because you need to figure out how to allow people to be healthy as they age and be independent and preferably productive, because otherwise you will have an increasingly disabled population that's supported by a smaller and smaller fraction of younger workers. So I think there are real reasons for doing serious aging research.
But with that, because we were speaking earlier in the program about intergenerational fairness and about being able to pass the baton in the workspaces onto a younger generation, I will throw out one stat that you mentioned, that we do our best work before we're 45.
I think on the whole...
This is Venky's words, not mine.
I think on the whole that's true. I think you could do very good work later in life, but often the seed ideas, the big ideas, originated earlier. And don't forget that older scientists often surround themselves by very young people, you know, brilliant young scientists who actually do a lot of, well, they do all the work, but they also do a lot of the creative thinking.
I see nodding in the audience.
Yeah, and people so, nodding, so I yes. think that is actually true.
what happens then if people live longer and if we give the baton over to younger people in the workplace? What are those 70, 80, 90-year-olds supposed to do? And that comes back to the research on aging. Like, I don't think any government has figured it out.
No, that's true. I think it's, on the one hand, it would be unfair for older people to simply hog all the resources that, you know, would be better utilized by younger people. On the other hand, it would also be unfair to take a perfectly functional older person and, you know, put them out to pasture. So I think what we have to do as we age is to find productive roles that are appropriate for older people. And that can vary depending on the profession. Now, if you're doing hard physical labor, you may not want to keep doing that past 60 or 65. You know, you're really, your body is physically tired out, and many of them don't want to do that. And so you have to find other roles for older people that make them feel productive and part of society. One other thing is that we tend to segregate, increasingly developed societies tend to segregate old people. They put them in nursing homes, care homes, retirement communities, etc. And that's not how we evolved. And I think it's better to really have integration of generations in society so that young people can see older people, perhaps, you know, learn from them, and older people then feel part of society as they get older.
I'd be curious with our audience, show of hands, should there be compulsory retirement? Oh, just two, and I see one at the very back, maybe three. So very few, I'm going to say.
We are in an academic city, so.
So you do talk about that. Yeah, you feel that academia in particular, people hang on.
They do hang on. And I will tell you something. I work in a research institute. I've noticed a very curious phenomenon. The people who are doing non-academic jobs, even people who are doing IT and so mm-hmm. on, and certainly people who are doing maintenance, plumbing, the cleaners, they all want to retire as soon as possible, okay? But my fellow scientists, many of them would like to hang on. As I said, it's a fun job. You have them, a bunch of young people, and you know, you tell them what to do, and and you know, they go off and do it. Okay.
But
so I think that tenure is okay as long as there's a retirement age. But if you abolish retirement age and have tenure, I think that's not a great combination, because then, you know, somebody could not be very productive or not really be worth, you know, taking up that slot, and then there's no real way to get rid of them.
So you talk about, coming back to the aging, that the thing that changes when we get older is short-term memory. I'm just talking about in the workspace. And you also say that racism, sexism, we try and push back against that in the workplace and make it a more diverse and equal workspace. But you feel that there is, and perhaps I'm paraphrasing your words here, so correct me, but that there's almost some truth with ageism, because we do actually age.
Yeah, there's no question that many of our abilities decline with age. And we're all perfectly happy to accept that we cannot run 100 meters as fast as we could when we were 20 years old. But we don't like the idea that our brains are not as functional
or
sharp either. And that's because we identify very closely with our thinking and our thoughts. And we don't like the idea that that's declined. But there's no question that many areas of cognition decline with age. And so people have talked about different kinds of intelligence. So there's what's called fluid intelligence. This is the ability to learn new things.
Mm-hmm. Like play the piano or a language.
Like learning a new language mm-hmm. or a piano. You'd be much worse than an eight-year-old at learning that. On the other hand, there's other things called crystallized intelligence. This is really accumulation of knowledge, vocabulary. Those decline more slowly. And so, again, my point is that as you age, you have to adapt your role to your strengths and not insist on doing the things that you were able to do well when you were younger.
But how do we know that?
How do we know what?
How do we know what we're really good at or not? Because if we're already biased in our thinking about our brain or our memory or what we're good at or what we're not good at.
Don't worry, other people will tell you.
I'm not really looking forward to that. But thank you, Venky. I'm curious, coming back to the retirement question with our audience that is in the room here. Most of them are not in favour of compulsory retirement. What do you think about retirement at 65? Is that a good idea? Show of hands. Maybe about 20%. What about 70? One or two. What about if you didn't have to retire until you were 80? Yeah, a smattering. This is really interesting because looking at it, every age conjures up something different, I think, for these people in the room of what is the right age to retire. What do you think, Venky?
I think I could have productively retired 3 years ago, but I did renew a grant because we were in the middle of things, and I plan to retire next year. So I'm 71 currently, and I think that's not a bad thing. We're still productive, we're still publishing in good journals, but the reality is that my retirement isn't going to slow down the pace of my field at all. And so I think it's fine, and I've had a good innings, and there are many other things I can do.
What will you do after you retire?
I haven't quite decided, but there's no shortage of things. I have lots of interests. Yeah.
Questions from the room. Hello, what's your name? Where are you from?
Juliet Gammon from Oxford. To do with retirement, there is masses of things you can do afterwards that are very fulfilling. I had to retire prematurely early because I was made redundant.
May I ask what... Sorry, go ahead. I think you're going to tell me what age you were.
61.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gone on doing what I do, which is editing and writing and everything, but for volunteer newsletters and things like that. But the question I was going to ask earlier was, we read a lot about the Japanese diet enabling them to live so long. And you haven't spoken about diet and exercise and their effect on aging. I mean, my aunt lived to 94 and she always said, I'm like the Queen Mother, I run on gin. So it's about the diet, exercise and alcohol.
So I point out that currently, despite all of the anti-aging research, the combination of diet, exercise and sleep. By diet, I mean a moderate and balanced diet and sufficient exercise and adequate sleep, which is often underestimated. That trio works better than any anti-aging supplement or drug on the market today. But I should also point out that those very things also help you with cholesterol and with blood pressure. And despite knowing that, I couldn't prevent the inexorable rise of my cholesterol and blood pressure, and I have to be on medication. So I think some of the anti-aging community would say, well, we're going to try to see if we can go one step better. How successful they'll be is not really clear, but you're quite right about diet and exercise, but I would add sleep to that.
Yeah, sleep. I'm a big proponent of sleep. We are having another of our conversations off forward thinking about veganism. Is that something that you have thought about when it comes to extending lifespan or perhaps even a better way of having a healthy life?
I wouldn't be so prescriptive, but I would say I'm a vegetarian, but I'm not a missionary about it. But I would say that having a healthy and moderate diet, which includes a good component of fruits and vegetables, is probably one of the ingredients that is useful for a healthy life.
You are listening to Forward Thinking from the BBC World Service. We are broadcasting from the Oxford Literary Festival at Worcester College. We are speaking about why we die and why we age. We have a live audience with us here asking some of the questions of my guest, Venky Ramakrishnan, who is a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry. One other aspect before I go to another listener question that came in. Restricting calories. A lot of people talk about that when they talk about a longer lifespan. You've looked into it a little.
Yeah, so this comes from studies in animals where if you restrict the amount of calories they consume to the bare minimum, this means they get enough to eat and no more. They don't lose weight, but they don't get any more than they absolutely need to live without losing weight or suffering malnutrition. When you do that to animals, those animals tend to live longer. And that's been shown in a variety of species. But of course, what they're comparing them to are animals that can eat as much as they want.
So
the control is unlimited food at unlimited times. This would be like comparing an abstemious human being with somebody who's gorging at an all-you-can-eat buffet, okay? So it's not a completely fair experiment, but nevertheless, it does show the importance of caloric restriction. And what people have found is they've identified a number of pathways that are influenced by caloric restriction, and some of them are major pathways that were only discovered in the last 20 or 30 years. And now they're thinking of seeing if they can inhibit those pathways and thereby mimic the effect of caloric restriction. And one of those compounds is currently a favorite of many anti-aging researchers as a candidate for solving some of the...
They use the acronym COR. It's kind of bandied about. That was new to me, but that's what it's all about if you see it. I want to play one of the messages that came into the BBC World Service Facebook page. This is from Divine, who's in the Niger Delta, Nigeria.
If longer life means more time aging or more time reproducing, then it's a no for me. Without youth, long life could be burdensome. Also, unchecked reproduction could sap up finite planetary resources, and society would be thrown into further problems.
So Divine isn't buying it, right? Burdensome is the word that he uses. If it's you're aging and your body is old and there's an awful lot of people on the planet and it could be bad for the planet as well as yourself.
Yeah, no, I think in the past, health advances have always been followed by a population rise, a dramatic increase in population. But then the population has stabilized at a new level. And in Japan, we have the interesting situation where life expectancy has gone up, but the population has not increased. It's actually declined or stayed steady. So there isn't an absolute rule that if you live longer, the population is going to increase. However, the alternative then is you would have a relatively stagnant society. You would have the same people living for longer and longer, and you'd have less frequent generational turnover. And if you look at all sorts of progress, progress often is made by young people. The young are simply bolder and more creative. Many scientific discoveries have been made by young people, and the same is true even in writers, as Kazuo Ishiguro once pointed out to the dismay of some of his fellow writers. So I think it wouldn't be such a great thing for everyone to live an extremely long time. But of course, there are other people who think it would be just fine.
Let's get some more questions in the room. Who had a couple? We have this lady over here who's been waiting. Hello, what's your name? Where are you from?
Hi, I'm Victoria. I'm from Austria, but currently living in Oxford as a student here. So my question would be referring back to health span and the role of the government. What would be things that, in your opinion, the government should incentivize financially or in any other way in order that the health span of people can be prolonged?
I think there are a number of things. First is biomedical advances to tackle some of the serious problems as we age. We mentioned dementia. Now, dementia is a big growing concern as we age, and currently there are really no good treatments for dementia. And so that, I would say, is one priority. But there are also other priorities, for example, heart disease, diabetes, obesity, which leads to many of these other problems and also accelerates aging. That's another big problem. So I think the government can do a number of things that ensure that we live healthily for longer. However, what happens at the other end? Will we have a rapid decline, or whether we will simply postpone a slow decline, that to me is not really clear.
Mm. So you talk about compressed morbidity. So that would be not having any of those diseases at the end of your life, or just having a very short period.
Yes,
off.
This is like the super centenarians who have a rapid decline.
A rapid decline, which I suppose I imagine everybody wants, right? Nobody wants to be ill at the end of their life.
That's what we want. But how to achieve that's not clear. It's as if, you know, you're functioning perfectly well. Well, why would you suddenly decline then if everything is healthy about you? So I think that question is still an unsolved problem.
One more question at the front here. Your name and where you're from.
My name is Michael Collins from Dublin, Ireland, and that brings me to the very point that you're making. There's a lot of discussion now about euthanasia, so would you like to address the topic?
Well, I joke in the book that Aldous Huxley showed the ultimate compression of morbidity all the way down to zero in his book Brave New World, where as soon as you reached a certain age, you would go off into these chambers, you know, to be euthanized. And of course, that's not what most of us want. I think euthanasia is a complicated issue. I can sympathize with people who are suffering terminal diseases and great pain or discomfort or simply have lost the will to live and wanting to end it in a civilized and painless way. I can sympathize with that. But I also think that it will lead to pressures from family members or even from society that, oh, you're taking up resources and hospital resources and so on and maybe financial resources and, you know, why don't you just go? So you can see both sides of the argument. So I think this is a complex problem that societies have to decide as a whole. It's not something for scientists or doctors to decide.
And of course, every society, well, not every, but many have very different takes on it. What about you? Your take?
Well, I agree very much with your second point that there is a great pressure and there will be increasing pressure. I read an article about a Japanese lady a few months ago, and what struck me was she said that she was going to die within a couple of weeks and she was going to be assisted in her death. And at the very end, she said, but her family would be happy. So it sounded almost as if she was going in order to make way for family pressure.
Yeah. I mean, if that was her own decision, it's one thing. But if it was a decision that was arrived at because of family pressure, even indirect, then, you know, you can see that's not a very nice thing. And it's not what we would want as a civilized society. So I think it's a hard question of how to allow it, but have really strong safeguards against that sort of thing. And I'm not sure how to achieve that. And I think each society will have to decide for its own. And societies have different ethical values about it as well. So,
question beside you there. Hello, what's your name? Where are you from?
Purna Mysore. I'm from University of Cambridge. With the technological advancements with AI and its impact into the future, maybe not right now, but several, maybe even decades later, if AI advancements are so significant that human brain might go into atrophy or something along those lines, do you see that impacting on human lifespan, health span, or generally on other sort of socioeconomic consequences of that sort of advancements?
I'm not sure that it'll affect our own lifespan. I think computers are already doing a lot of things that we used to do ourselves. But what we've done is we've started doing different things. And so I think humans will always find other things to do, but maybe I'm being naively optimistic.
I know they did have a story recently about AI scans that were detecting breast cancer before it even could be detected by mammograms or by the human eye with the scan. And so I suppose the lifespan is affected in some ways by that. We are going to have another discussion on AI and the ethics of AI as part of our programme, our series of programmes for forward thinking on the BBC World Service, particularly looking at feminism and how it affects gender and the ethics of that on AI. Do you think we will ever defeat death?
As I said, I don't think there's a physical law against expanding lifespan significantly. Defeating death is an absolute term. It means that we'll never die. And I think that's a mirage, because even if you expanded life, let's say we now have a natural limit of about 120 years. Let's say we expanded it to 300 years. I think what will happen is there'll be processes of aging that no matter how much we correct for, will slowly proceed. So I don't think it's realistic. And of course, don't forget that aging is only one cause of death. There are all sorts of environmental causes. There are accidents, there's predation, there's war, you know, there's climate change, starvation, all sorts of things. So I think, you know, this idea of real immortality is an illusion.
Thank you so much, Venki Ramakrishnan, the Nobel Prize winner for chemistry. I'm Nuala McGovern. You've been listening to Forward Thinking, an edition of the documentary podcast from the BBC World Service. The producer was Julian Siddle. Do join us next time when we'll be discussing whether we need more diversity in space.
The information spaces we inhabit can resemble a hall of mirrors.
It's called guided democracy or managed democracy. There are different parties, different candidates, but everyone knows who is going to win.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast helping you make sense of them.
We've seen a crackdown on the opposition. We've seen an increase in censorship.
That's The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.